We made this.
And welcome back to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I am your host, Tony Black, and I'm joined for this very special episode to see out 2021 by regular host and showrunner of the show, Carl Sweeney. How are you, Carl?
Hi, Tony. Merry Christmas. How are you doing?
Merry Christmas to you. I'm good. I'm good, mate. Yeah, obviously people will have heard the fun How the Ghost Stole Christmas roundtable script reading we did not so long back, but we thought we'd get on mic just to do a couple of little things for the year's out, including introduce this very special episode that we recorded back at the start of November, talking to Glenn Morgan. As if,
I mean, it's pretty special stuff, isn't it? It was a really good day. The whole thing was great. And it's so nice that we've got a recording out of it, isn't it, in terms of this interview with Glenn Morgan. And I think people will really dig it. He was great value, wasn't he? You've got to say.
Yeah. So this was part of the Square Eyes festival, TV festival, which was held in Birmingham in the UK, which is where I'm from. You live roughly, Carl. Kurt came down for it and joined us on stage at the Midland Arts Centre, which is a lovely theatre/cinema/community space in the middle of this park called Cannon Hill Park, just in South Birmingham. A great place we've frequented a few times, haven't we, Carl? We've been to see like Apocalypse Now there and stuff, and it's a lovely building, I think.
Yeah, it's a great venue, just across the road from Edgbaston Cricket Ground, for anyone who knows Birmingham. It's really nice. They've had a tough time during the pandemic, as a lot of comparable venues have, I think, in terms of visitor numbers and things. So if anyone is local or able to get there, it's well worth it. Of course, as we record, we don't know. We're kind of getting into a rough patch again with COVID, aren't we? So
there could be some
who knows what 2022
breakers
will bring. Yeah. This is it. We don't know if things are going to have to close again. But no, we had a great time there. Like you say, we've been there before many times. I've actually worked at the venue to do some teaching there. That's a conflict of interest I need to flag up, I suppose, when I'm praising it. The Square Eyes Festival was the first time they'd run this at the venue, isn't it? Hopefully it'll become an annual thing or a regular thing. So it was pretty cool that we were invited. Well, not just the X-Cast, was it? As the X-Cast, but also as the Time Is Now podcast with Kurt, of course.
With Kurt. And yeah, it was very nice to be invited by the guys behind it. And, you know, we were in fairly illustrious company. You know, there were other podcasts and events going on. They had like Jed Mercurio, the writer of Line of Duty, which is a big TV show in the UK. They had, you know, lots of different stuff going on across 2 weeks. So it was great. It was great. We had a modest but very involved and engaged audience who managed to come out. So if you did come out, and some of you will know who you are listening to this, thank you so much for coming and supporting us. And you guys were there for our conversations, because we talked about the episodes Home and for the X-Files and The Curse of Frank Black for Millennium. Sadly, those recordings, I think, are lost to the ages. They will go down like Greek myths, Carl, to be discussed
forever. Well, I think
forever.
There were some great moments there. I think some of our finest ever podcasting, it's fair to say. And also just some great comedy, like with Matt Latham there, who really didn't like The Curse of Frank Black, which... He was kind of scared, wasn't he? He was worried he wasn't going to get a lift home from you.
He was touch and go, to be honest, you know, as is our friendship now. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
He's got a lot to be fair,
did he even want a lift home? Because I think there were some issues with your car, weren't there? I think I should tell that story.
Go on then. You might as well.
Right. So we had a great day. We'd recorded live episodes of the X-Cast, and the time is now. We'd interviewed one of our heroes, one of our X-Files heroes, Glenn Morgan, and it was really, really cool. I think our original plan was to go for a drink at the venue, wasn't it, straight afterwards? But Tony said, no, it's all right. I've got a great idea. I know a fantastic place.
Like Michael Caine in The Italian Job.
Wait a minute, lads. So that caused a problem, first of all, because you had room for Matt and Luke Winch, didn't you? But you couldn't give me and Kurt a lift, so we split up.
Tiny
you...
car,
But you were going to go off ahead of us. We were going to get a taxi. First problem was that it was Bond night, wasn't it? So the Edgbaston Cricket Ground had had a very expensive fireworks display, which finished at the same time as our show. So there was no, you know, there was just gridlock on the streets, wasn't there? There was just traffic everywhere.
It's terrible. Yeah, it was awful.
So we were waiting for ages for a taxi. Anyway, after we split up, a few minutes go by, and then Kurt and I hear this, like, god-awful, like, scraping noise on the ground. And we sort of have a look over. This car's coming towards us. It's, like, sparking. And what's going on? It's, like, the front number plate had fallen down and was dragging along the ground. And Kurt turns to me and says, look at this fucking idiot driving along with his number plate hanging off.
Yeah, that's and an actual quote. He actually said
verbatim quote.
Yeah.
And then you get the car gets closer and closer. What's going on? I think a steward from the venue like leaps into the road to like remonstrate with the driver, like, hey, what are you doing? Your number plate's hanging off. Yeah. And of course, as it pulls nearer, the penny drops because we realize, oh my God, that's Tony's car. What's going on?
Yeah, and I
so have you sorted it out, Tony?
I had no end of problems with this thing, because it was an old number plate, which I got replaced thinking it would work. And then I drove all the way to Birmingham, 100 miles north. And on the way home, I then managed to get it fixed via a very circuitous route to Halfords, which is our one of our garages in the UK that fix it. But yeah, that was a sign of the night to come. No, it was great. We had a good time. We went out for a curry, went out for some beers. We had a good laugh. And it was just a lovely day. It was a really lovely day. They were really welcoming at the Mac, and Glenn, as you'll hear, was so lovely. You know, he's a very nice man. He's equally his wife, Kristen Cloak Morgan, as a lot of people will know from the X-Files and Millennium and more, helped set this interview up. She is a lovely lady too, just the loveliest people. And Glenn was full of stories, full of enthusiasm, really generous with his time. The only disappointing thing is that the recording misses out our introduction at the very beginning. So it kind of cuts in a little bit as Kurt is asking a question, but you're only missing like about 2 or 3 minutes, maybe. The bulk of the conversation is there. And it's a good one, isn't it, Carl? I mean, he was on, for anyone who doesn't know, he was on our XCast Live in 2018. He popped on there for an hour and supported us in raising money for charity, but that's only been available to patrons and remains only available to patrons. And that was a great chat as well. But this one, I think this was even better this time around.
I think it was really, really good. I do, because obviously any X-Files fan has heard various interviews over the years with all the main people, you know, Chris Carter, the actors, people like Glenn Morgan, of course. So I was wondering, like, are we going to hear stuff here that we haven't heard before? And I don't know what you think. I think we did. I had heard some of the stories he brings up before, but he told them really well. And I'd also heard other things that I don't recall him saying elsewhere. So I'm confident people will enjoy this chat. He was just a very engaging guy, wasn't he? Like, it probably won't come across on the audio, but he prepared a few like little visual aids as well, because we had him on the big screen at the cinema where we could see him. Mm. Like, I think if I remember rightly, when we talked about Kim Manners, he held up like a memento, didn't he, to the camera and things like that. Yep. So yeah, no, he'd put a bit of thought into it. He'd rewatched the episodes before talking to us for the first time in, I think he said, quite a long time, didn't he?
Yeah, so, a few years.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure, I got to say. I think it really was. Yeah,
it was. He was a lovely man, and it's a great chat. And there's a few questions at the end as well, which audience members got in. So hopefully you're going to really enjoy this. We thought this would be a nice way to cap the year off and as we head into 2022. And, you know, we do have some plans. Obviously, Season 7's come to an end now. Hopefully you've enjoyed the Season 7 coverage. I have. I've been loving it as a listener, which has been fantastic. You guys, you, Kurt, Sarah, and everyone else have done amazing work with this. And there's some gold to come, isn't there, in 2022? So what can we expect, Carl, in the first few months?
So I think the rough plan is, and it might change, and, you know, obviously keep posted to things like the basement on Facebook for any updates. Yeah. But I think the plan is that we'll have a little bit of a breather in terms of the main coverage. Of course, Season 8 is coming up next, and we think that will begin around March. So we're looking forward to that. I think, obviously, it's one of Kurt's favourite seasons. I love Season 8 too. I think it's really good. Sarah is a bit more equivocal on the matter, I think. But it's going to be great fun, because we're going to, like, the three of us, I think me, you and Sarah, are going to sit down to talk about Roadrunners, for example, almost certainly. So
she's going to like it.
By the time we're finished, she's gonna begrudgingly like it, maybe. I think before that, to be confirmed, but I think we're going to do some like roundtables and special episodes in the early part of 2022 to keep things kind of ticking over. So that's going to be a lot of fun. I think, again, as ever, the X-Cast, there's always something going on. So season 8 is going to be fun because, you know, we've done things like with, for season 7, like the script episode that we did with me, Sarah and Kathy, which seemed to go down really well. So, you know, we're going to try and plan in like bonus episodes like that or different, you know, various different things over the course of the year. So it should be great fun, I think.
It will. And, you know, I think a lot of people are anticipating season 8 coverage because it's a dynamite little season for a lot of people. And it really polarizes, and I think it's going to be great to chat through it. And I can't wait. I'm going to be on a few of those episodes, as you've said, Roadrunners and a few others. And there's going to be some great bonus stuff. I know I'm going to be doing some more of the X-Files episode titles roundtables. Going to get through a couple more of those because that first one went down well. And Darren Mooney's going to come back and do some more Topps Comics chats with me as well for patrons initially. So there's going to be some really cool stuff as well going on. It's just going to be great. So there's lots of X-Files content to come next year. And who knows, you know, maybe we'll get some news on Albuquerque or a third movie or
season
a
12.
New season. Yeah, hey, you never know. You never know. Strange things have happened.
Yeah, you never know, because it's one of those things where there have been other times where I've been like, if you'd have said to me, is there going to be any new X-Files stuff? I'd have been like, nah. And in some ways, it kind of feels like that now. I don't know what you think, but in terms of just level of general interest out there and things like that. Yeah. But you never know. These things change. Like if you'd have said to me after I Want to Believe came out and didn't do that well financially, well, in a few years, you'll get two new seasons of the show itself. I'd have said, nah, you're having a laugh, you know? So. Yeah. Who knows? You never know.
The answers are there. You just have
to
know
where to look.
So, yeah, we'll see. 2022 is going to be another great year of the X-Cast either way, our seventh year on air. So it's going to be brilliant. So thank you to everyone who has listened over this year. Our numbers continue to be great. And we thank you all for everything you do in terms of listening and any patrons who are involved. You know, thank you so much to you guys for supporting the show, and thanks to anyone who's been on it, and special thanks from me to you, Carl, and Sarah and Kurt for being the best people and shepherding this wonderful show into another year. So it's been amazing again, so cheers
Tony, right back at you. Thanks for all you you know, thanks for everything you've ever done on About the X-Cast. It's been great.
Bless you. Well, I suppose it leaves us to queue up this interview, which you're gonna love. And I guess we just wish everyone a happy new year, and let's hope 2022, COVID or not, is great. It will be. Sod that alien virus. We'll beat it. We'll get a vaccine. Oh, we've already
isn't
got
there
one.
A,
we'll get another one.
We'll get another one. Isn't there a saying, like, things will be all right in the end? And if it's not all right, that means it's not the end.
It means it's not the end.
I think that's what I'm thinking.
You know? No, I like that. Right, well, yeah. We'll see you in 2022, guys. Enjoy Glenn and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Glenn, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. Obviously, the subject matter of home is very tense. It's very disturbing. But I think what struck us is that there was a lot of laughter in the room as the episode went on. There's some great gags in there. And I'm just wondering about your approach to humor when you write for the X-Files. Is that something that just comes naturally to you, or were you very conscious of the need to inject a bit of levity into that particular story? What would you say?
Well, you know, as I really thought I'd follow a path like my brother. I really thought I was going to go down comedy, but I loved horror, and my favorite pieces of horror all have humor. You know, it's like the Exorcist, the devil, unfortunately, is very funny. You know, that would be much too vulgar a display of power. Is just funny. Hitchcock talked about the importance of humor, and, you know, Psycho. I've read that Hitchcock thought of Psycho as a comedy. And I understand that now. And so I think that's just like the way Jim and I and Darren like approach things. And you have an actor like, you know, Duchovny, like David, who and Jillian, who became really good at it, you know. And so, you know, I rewatched it last night, and there's like so many things. I'm like, oh, that's David. He just makes that up. He just made that up. And, you know, we all know that that's, you know, what he's going to do. And, you know, and I think it also, humor helps to actually increase tension later, because you've allowed it to, you know, people to, you know, to go up and down. If you just had them up here the whole time, they're going to get tired. If you have them at this level down here, they're bored. And so, you know, the approach is always to try to, you know, have more of a roller coaster. That'd be a horrible roller coaster if it just went like that.
I think one of the other things we were talking about in both discussions actually is the use of music in these episodes, the use of popular songs, which you tend to use in quite surprising and somewhat counterintuitive ways. So of course, Wonderful, Wonderful in this episode in Home. I was just wondering about the process of like selecting a song like that. Would you go through a whole bunch of songs before you get to the one you wanted? Or was it like immediate, you know, that's the song for that scene, you know?
Go through a bunch of beloved songs before we ruin them for people forever. You know, I think I've thought about this, and I've narrowed it down to, I think the first time I ever came across it when I was a kid watching The Birds, and Tippi Hedren goes off to smoke a cigarette and the kids are all singing. I believe it's a Scottish folk song that if I want to make my wife crazy, I just start singing that song. She just like makes her nuts. And I just thought the counter, the way that increased tension by having the sweet song, I just thought was brilliant. And I don't recall if we did it, you know, like in 21 Jump Street and stuff like that. We experimented with it and that. And for me, the key to it is to find a song that no one's really said out front, like, that's creepy.
Yeah.
There's just an uncanny thing. And so, yeah, you listen to a bunch of them. My mom was a huge Johnny Mathis fan. That's not Johnny Mathis in the show. And I just knew that song and that kind of whistle at the beginning. Ooh, it just something weird about it. And it just kind of, everybody agrees, you know? And so that's always a thing, you know, it's like years later online, somebody said, you know, knock it off, guys. You do it all the time. And I felt bad and I stopped it. And then I regretted it.
Yeah.
And so the last few things I kind of went back to it. I really enjoy that trick.
Yeah. And I think we all really love the Sheriff Taylor murder sequence. We think it's a great set piece. Of course, this episode was directed by the late, great Kim Manners, the man who directed more episodes of the show than anybody else did.
Let's see. I know I can have screen share, but this is a lot quicker. This is from his memorial.
Wow.
And I don't want to interrupt, but I did in thinking about it. You know, Jim Wong and I met Kim Manners at Stephen J. Cannell, who is known primarily for doing the A-Team. Jim and I was on 21 Jump Street, and Steve was an old timer who got his start on Adam 12 that Jack Webb had produced. So Jim Wong and I were raised by a lot of real old timers, of a lot of guys that we really watched and really respected. And Kim was one of those guys. And, you know, his family was, you know, one of these families that you don't hear a lot about. They go through, his father was a producer, a line producer. His brother became assistant director for us on Space Above and Beyond. They've just, a lot of people that you'll never know about really make things run. And Kim was a great director, but he had a reputation of being a Cannell guy. You know, that 45 minutes and you catch the bad guy and he's just kind of crap. And when Jim and I came over from Cannell, we fought hard was Bob Goodwin was the producer. We said, we want Dave Nutter and Kim Manners. And they wouldn't do either one of them because they thought they were Cannell guys. And it was killing us because Kim is a great director who was just kind of pigeonholed and assumed that he just did crappy television. But you knew if he had his chance, he would light it up. And then a director dropped out and they didn't have anybody and they brought in Kim. I think that was that episode. I think it was The Hand of Erlitz, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just hit a home run. Chris made him a producer like before he was done filming it. And Kim was just a really great collaborator. He could, you know, call you up and guy, hey, this shit, this scene, I don't know, what are you doing? I'm like, okay, well, go like this way. Yeah, okay. And, you know, and it's rare to find that kind of a teamwork and collaboration. I think down the line here, remind me about the final mix showing the censor with Kim Manners. So to remind me, that's like my favorite story associated with this show.
We will. Maybe that's one to finish out in a bit. Yeah. Kurt, you've got anything?
Sorry, did I answer that question? Because I'm
that's lovely. Thank you.
That's great. Right. Thank you.
Yeah, I just the focus on Scully was something that became apparent to me on this watch, that she was very much forefront in putting the case together as such, and Mulder kind of took a little bit of a back seat. Was that something that you were consciously writing when you wrote for Scully for Home? And also as well, the kind of the way that it was delivered, that the inclusion of them that being a mother and things like that, was that kind of something that came from yourselves?
You know, I my side of it is that Jillian and I always had a creative connection. I mean, we don't really go to dinner. I don't know if I've ever been to dinner with her. You know, it's not like we're buddies. You know, Dave's a friend of the family, kind of go hang out and everything. But Jillian, you know, she was always somewhere else. But there was a creative connection, you know, that, you know, I forget the title, Beyond the Sea. It was really about watching my mom, watching my grandfather pass away, and just to apply that. And Jillian just understood it, and really to show executives how great an actress she is. And so there was just a silent understanding of where that character was heading and what her thoughts were. And that, you know, Jillian, you know, becoming a mom and all those type of things that were just going on in our lives, it made its way into the show. And to try to, you know, mature those characters, you know, who for a couple of years are just running around looking for aliens, kind of.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Beyond the Sea there in specifically, because it feels like a lot the Home and a lot of the episodes you wrote on the X-Files have a continuing fascination with Americana, maybe even 50s or 60s Americana, and that kind of American myth making that happens. We see this in Home, we see it in The Curse of Frank Black in later, but is that something that's conscious in yours and with these episodes, James Wong's writing, and that is that something you're looking to bring out in the use of music, the use of visual, the use of themes and ideas in your stories?
I don't know. Interesting. I never thought of it that. I think that's just who we are. You know, I grew up in central New York and just, you know, played baseball and saw movies and that's who I was. Jim, you know, was a really young kid, grew up in Hong Kong and then moved to Oregon and then down to El Cajon outside of San Diego, California, where we met. And that's what we did. We went to see Star Wars and we went to see Padres and the Chargers play and those type of things. And that's just how we grew up. So it wasn't an analysis or injection of all that Americana.
In terms of what things you grew up and saw, I'm thinking of influences. We've talked a little bit today about how we feel Home at points evokes things like the Hills Have Eyes or the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Were they films that, those kind of horror films, were they important to you as well?
You know, I think for all of us can admit that even if we're fans or known for a genre or your friends, like there's some films that slip through the cracks. And the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was one for me.
Yeah, okay.
I had never seen it by the time we wrote Home. I can tell you what things I drew from to get Home, but it was like later we were on a show called The Others.
Oh yeah.
And Toby Hooper directed an episode, and like he's a great guy. I got to know him, and then I went and watched it. Right. And also, Jim and I were also at New Line when they did the remake with Lee Ermey, who is a pal of ours. And that's when I start to understand and appreciate that movie. But for me, it was first and foremost the Universal monster movies. It's just October's over. Every October, I go through them all. All of them. The Universal horror movies. There used to be a TV show where I grew up in Syracuse. It was called the Monster Movie Matinee, and there was a host, you know, and he was in a coffin. You only saw his hand, and there was dry ice, and they would show the Wolfman and Dracula and Frankenstein, and they're just like great. That's that. Then it became Hitchcock, and then, you know, I grew up in the 70s, so I think that's like, to me, Rosemary's Baby is a little earlier, but The Exorcist, The Omen, Halloween, Black Christmas, Bob Clark's. I just, that movie was just,
it's a fantastic film.
It's a fantastic film. I got to know him because I did a remake, and he was just a really underrated, overlooked filmmaker. Pretty interesting kind of guy. I think of him like Thomas Mitchell in It's a Wonderful Life, the uncle that has to tie a string. That's what Bob Clark was like. But, you know, you can really see how much Halloween borrowed from Black Christmas. Anyway, those are the films that, you know, and then also, you know, your kid and my brother and I would want, I don't know, some things that I can't even remember. He'll call me up and go, this movie's on, the Food of the Gods, where these like hamsters were, you know, just stuff like The Devil's Reign, where they had, you know, that, like that thing in Raiders of the Lost Ark where the guy's face melt. That was the big thing. And Ernest Borgnine and John Travolta and The Devil's Reign. So there's just like crappy B movies that were all part of it. And television, Twilight Zone. I just worked on the Twilight Zone and feel like a little, like I let the whole thing down, you know. But the, when I did my first Twilight Zone for Jordan, and you write that part where Rod Serling would have spoke, I just had a walk around my backyard. I just had chills. That Twilight Zone and the Night Gallery and all that stuff, all those things were what I like.
Well, they were so influential in the X-Files as well, weren't they? And you know, so I can totally see that. You might be maybe happy to know that Kurt and I, at least every Halloween, make it a tradition to watch The Curse of Frank Black. Genuinely.
Well, we're very different, because I just watched it the other night for the first time in years, and I was going, what happens? What next? You know, as long as we're skipping shows a little bit and talking, touching Twilight Zone, you know, a huge, I know we're talking about Home, but before I forget, you know, Tom Wright, who directed so many and was a producer on Millennium. I mean, he, a Night Gallery, those, you know, they always had the painting, the artwork. That Rod Serling would come in and talk about. Tom Wright did those paintings.
Did he?
Yeah, there's a couple books out now that are, and they've had some displays. A lot of the original paintings got ripped off by the prop guys and stuff back then. But, and then Tom worked for Hitchcock. Tom just tells me endless Hitchcock stories and stuff. So that's another case where, like, some, you know, old timers guys have been. Tom Wright, he did the storyboards on Apocalypse Now. So he gave me these color Xerox of like the helicopters coming over the waves. You know, that's him. That's Coppola going, come up with some stuff. And now all those originals are in the Coppola winery up in Napa. So, you know, and Tom Wright, he, for Terms of Endearment, when Nicholson flies out of the car on the beach, he shot that. Diamonds Are Forever, the chase scene down Las Vegas.
Wow.
He shot that.
No idea.
And so, yeah, I just didn't want to come out here and not, you know, Kim Manners and Tom Wright.
Yeah.
Like my heroes.
Yeah, we love them. Absolutely.
I just wanted to ask about Karen Carnival, really. I mean, she's absolutely unforgettable in that role as Mrs. Peacock. And we know that you've also worked with her on other occasions, too. Can you just tell us a bit about her? She just seems like an actor who absolutely throws herself into her work, into her parts with complete commitment, you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That show... what we usually did on the X-Files, well, most of this is what you did at Cannell, is the writers would go up there and kind of prep it. So you would cast, you'd go around with locations, you'd talk to the directors. And so whatever was going on, I don't know if I was writing The Cancer Man or what, but Jim prepped Home and I did a post-production. I edited it and did all that stuff. So now why am I telling you this? Oh, so I didn't meet Karen. Jim cast her. And she's phenomenal. So I don't know how many years go by. I think I did Black Christmas in 2005. And we're reading people for the mother. I don't know. I just, you know, it's like, that's how it is in this business. You just kind of, these people are great. And then it just goes out of your head, out of sight, out of mind or whatever. And this woman comes in and I've never seen her. But her voice is unmistakable. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. You know, and I look at a resume and I'm like, let me tell you, I've never met you. But since 1997, not a month goes by where I don't have to explain you. She's like, oh, the same thing. And like, we just hit it off and became really great friends. And she told me a story that she had gone to a dinner. like a week, and she lives in Vancouver. And she'd been to a dinner there the week after Home had aired, and people were talking about it. And then Karen just goes, "I was the mom." And then people that party go, "No." And she goes, "Yeah, I'm hungry." And the people start screaming.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, she's Maurice in the Planet of the Apes movies. I mean, through motion capture. And she's just great. I mean, I don't know how many people saw Black Christmas. And, you know, I sort of got that movie's tarnished because of Bob Weinstein. But her performance is Karen. She's just great.
Yeah.
And she seems to get a lot of enjoyment still from being associated with Home. Like when we interviewed her on the podcast, she very quickly lapses into the voice, which is really
yeah.
And I think
she has the Twilight Zone. She did. Sorry, she did an episode of Twilight Zone that Jennifer Goodwin is in.
Yeah,
that she came up to me. I had written this thing. She's a bad guy. I forget. And she did it in the cadence of Ma Peacock, emphasizing words that. I thought, what the hell are you talking about? And then when I watched her do it, she's like, it was like a coded message to X-Files fans. It was like, it's crazy.
Yeah. No.
Even- and she's also, of course, sorry, but I can't, her, that last season when she played as a plus one, where she was like four parts, she was just amazing. Because I wanted her to be the Barbara Hershey character in this. Oh. And then Chris called me up and said, can I have Karen? I want her to play all these parts. I'm like, yeah, because Karen told me once her goal as an actor was to play a man or to be a ventriloquist who only spoke through the puppet. And so
when was that episode then?
I know. Yeah. So playing a man, Chris had heard that and came up with that episode.
I think even last weekend she posted something on social media, didn't she, where she did the Mrs. Peacock voice again.
Yeah, she did.
She loves that stuff. It's really fun. Does.
Yeah. She's really nice and she's everything you want her to be. Really, really great.
She's lovely.
I suppose, Glenn, you teed us up a bit earlier when you mentioned the censors. So when you wrote the script for Home, I guess alarm bells were set off at that point. What was that process like of bringing the episode to the screen, you know?
Well, first off, because I have all my show and tell things, I don't want to, I give this throughout the year short shrift, but this is this book. I don't know where I came across it. The Dark Nature by Lyle Watson. And in it is very much like, is nature moral? You know, a sick bird, a little bird in a nest, if it's sick, the mother kicks it out. They're not making it, it's out. It's just what happens in the teaser. And so the idea was, what if we had a group of humans who behaved like nature does, you know? Everybody loves a sea otter, but man, they're bastards. They like gang rape and a mallard duck's the same way. And so it was just kind of gone, you know, really take, there's stuff in here. I'm sure I was looking here and there's notes that I'm sure Mulder says near verbatim out of that book. I haven't looked at it for 25 years, but that was an influence. My wife, Kristen, had said, you've got to see this movie, Brother's Keeper. And then what she said was like, oh, it's like this family. There was a documentary about a family in like, I don't know, Arkansas or down south somewhere, crazy, about these incestuous brothers. And then it's about, did one murder the other? And so then I watched the movie and it was like Onondaga County, where I grew up. It wasn't Arkansas. I'm like, this is where I'm from. And, you know, those Joe Berliner and Bruce Sanofsky, and they did Paradise Lost, and Bruce did the Metallica movie, Some Kind of Monster. And so they're really great documentarians. And I saw that movie and it just had another big influence on me. Start putting the thing together. And that's all it was. That's all that we were. And those, all the stuff we talked about before, Scully is a mother. How can you be scary? If these guys are just, people are just acting, they're not a part of our culture. Are they wrong? Like the book was proposing. Is nature wrong, or what was Shakespeare? Nothing's right or wrong, thinking makes it so, type of thing. Then I'd be remiss to not mention that while Jim and I were thinking out the story, and I don't know where it came up that the mother was I don't know how we came up with these brothers in the house and whatever. But at one point we're struggling And I said, I always wanted to, when I was a kid out of film school, I had read Charlie Chaplin's autobiography. And I remembered it, totally bizarre. But in it, he said that, you know, he was just getting started in traveling in a production of Sherlock Holmes, and he was a teenager. And he goes to this small town that I believe is in Wales, and he's staying in a cheap kind of tenement. And he's there with his family, a bunch of miners, which is another part, like, you know, my dad's side of the family are Welsh. So all the kind of freak elements of this show are reflective of my background. And so the man who lived there said to Chaplin, oh, I want to show you something. And they go in the kitchen and open up the cupboards and pull out a legless man who was in the cupboard sleeping. And he was big and strong, but had a flat square head. And they go, okay, now dance, Gerald or Gilbert or whatever his name is. And the man with his hands leapt up as high as Chaplin. And he goes, what do you think? Wouldn't he be good in the circus? The human frog. And Chaplin is like horrified, but gives him some, well, maybe you could call this guy, or, you know. And so I remember that story as a family having a teenager under a bed that they rolled out and plopped up. And then that's how I remembered it wrong. And in working it out, Jim Wong goes, it's the mother under the bed. I'm like, oh, then the whole story, you work it out. So there's nothing that I felt that we were going, let's get kicked off of TV. Let's really mess people up tonight. I really thought that we were doing, is man a part of nature immoral? That's what I thought we were doing. And I just wrote that, worked out that story. I wrote it. And then actually Kristen and I went to London for a week or two, and I came back. And the first, before we filmed, the head of production for Fox, who was a friend of ours, his name Charlie Goldstein, he calls me up and he goes, you're sick. You two are sick. And then hangs up the phone. I'm like, what? So that was the first indication, but I never thought that. But I'm sorry, I know it's a long-winded, just stop me. But Fox has every place has what's known as standards and practices, what we all call the censor, and you get the script and they take this out and this is no good, and you negotiate with them. And I didn't really get that many notes from them. You know, X-Files was a big hit and it was a little untouchable. So we got a lot of leeway at the time. But then I started to get a sense, like I said, I was editing it, and I started to get a sense, well, maybe this will be a problem. And so our standards and practices executive, her name was Linda Shimatsuno. And although we argued, we were friends with her. And so I invited her into the editing room, which the editor of that episode, Michael Stern, his father had been the executive producer of Get Smart, Leonard B. Stern. It was another Get Smart. It was like another, it was just, great to be in the same room with him. And so the three of us cut that episode together. Never did it before, never did it since, that I cut an episode with standards and practices. And we would have rules, like, you know, in American baseball, if the batter breaks his wrist on a check swing, it's still called a strike, so penalized. He's still, a strike is called against him. So if you watch that episode, at no point do the brothers go beyond here. So when we're watching the thing, you know, the editor, go back. Okay, cut. You know, that's what it was like. And later on, you know, we get letters going, I don't appreciate seeing brains splattered across my screen. And like, there's no brains. There's, when you watch it, what you see is not that, you know, it's pretty, it's not tame, but it's not as falls out as everybody thinks. And the interesting thing was, the person who was most offensive was, when we were done, was Linda Shimatsuno. You know, and so it went out, and I don't know, all hell broke loose. I guess now I'll get to that point. You know, when you're done, you get all the sound, and you got the music and the effects and the dialogue and everything, and you got a big board and a bunch of guys spend hours mixing that all together properly. That was done by a place out in Burbank, which is 15 miles away from Fox. And there was a fiber optic cable that went to a room at Fox where producers and whoever would go to that room and check out the mix and give notes. Well, that should be louder. Take that out. Blah, 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 blah. So Paul Rablin, who was the producer of Post, before Linda Shimasuno comes in, and Kim Manners hadn't come in either, before they come in, he's like, look, oh, what was one of the notes? Make sure the baby doesn't sound sick. Or no, make sure the baby does sound sick. Because that's the reason they're burying it. And so, okay, so it's like, you know, it's like baby's got a cold. Paul Rablin says at the last minute, Glenn, I found this thing. I want to play it for you. It's great, but I don't know. I'm like, okay, play it. And it's just the baby screaming. And it's just like, whatever it is, the intensity of that teaser, if you think it's big now, like Tarantino level, it was, oh my God. And it was great. And they throw the dirt and that goes, and it's just great. I'm like, okay, okay, okay. I said, everybody who's in the room, Kim Manners is not in the room at that point. I'm like, okay, no one, don't anyone speak. Let me do the talking here. Because this will take a little work. So don't set her off. So Linda comes in. She's real nice. And I'm like, okay, Linda, I know we talked about it before, but Paul's found this thing. And boy, it really makes it good. But, and I think it keeps, you know, the baby sick and all that kind of bullshitting, manipulating, you know, kind of thing. And she's like, okay, I'm open to it. And she's a friend and she was open to it. So she starts, they start playing it. And it's like, it's, I don't know if they have it on the DVD. I don't remember, but it was just like, ah, this baby's just like, oh my God, you've, this thing you've seen 20 times is so much more harrowing. At that point, Kim Manners walks in, you know, and Kim was like a little guy and he was like feisty, you know, and he's like, he's looking at it. And I'm looking at Kim going like, trying to signal like that. And it's done and it's crying and they put the dirt on and everything. It's like, it just stops and everybody's quiet. And then Kim Manners goes, that was fucking bitching. And then standards and practices lady just goes, no. And that was it. I was never going to win that fight. And I'm like, thanks, Kim. But it was like funny. So
you're saying that you did the edit. Was there anything left out of the edit that you would like to have kept in?
Not that I recall. I don't know if there's some scenes that are walking or talking or whatever. You know, there's stuff. I had called Kim one time and I'm like, hey, you know, and Brothers Keeper, these guys walked, when they walked down the street, it was in the order of when they were born. So the oldest always went first. And so some kind of like thing like that, some sort of primate movement. And there was just there was stuff on the dailies where these guys looked like the monkeys in Space Odyssey walking out the floor. I'm like, whoa, what are you doing? That stuff is never going back in. But I don't think so. It's just like that episode, you know, came together.
Yeah, no, it did. Before we move on and talk about Curse Frank Black, one, I'm sure you've addressed this before, but there's long been talk about how you wanted to bring the Peacocks back in Millennium. In season two. So how far along did you get with that? Did you have a story? Did you have ideas? I know it obviously never happened, but how far along was it, that idea?
I don't recall having a story, but I did call Karen Carnival and check her availability. And we were going down the road. Jim and I would have, I mean, that was what you do sometimes as TV writers is like, we need a Christmas show. And then you come up with a story. And so you just go, we've got Karen Carnival and the Peacocks. What are we going to do? So we were going to do it. But yeah, I got a call from Peter Roth, who had Jim and I worked with at Cannell, and he's the one responsible for us being on X-Files and just a great mentor to us. And he said the lobbyist, the congressional lobbyist for Fox, somehow got wind that we were doing this and called up and said, those characters never appear on television again, which is chilling.
Yeah. It's really sad as well, because I think we all agree that it would have been fantastic to see them up
against Frank Black, really. So it's a real shame that never got to happen.
I think Frank probably could have become a peacock.
Well, he was going down a road in The Curse of Frank Black. So let's move on and talk about that. Obviously, this is...
No, hang on. I got one more thing.
Oh, go on.
I don't think I've ever brought it. No, I'm sorry. I have some notes when I was watching it.
No, please do.
It's the only thing Vince Gilligan ever gave us. I don't mean it that way. I don't mean it that way. Vince Gilligan comes in because he's from Virginia and said it's not called the Civil War. It's the War of Northern Aggression. Wow, okay. And so that line that she says is Vince Gilligan's addition. But on social media and Reddit and stuff, people bitch about me using that term. And I just want to go, it's Vince Gilligan. You love him.
Put it on him. Yeah. That's great. Yeah, that's a really good term. But yeah, The Curse of Frank Black obviously is in the second season of Millennium, which you and James Wan come in and take over, really, show running while Chris Carter's doing a million other things at that time as well. And we've talked about how it's a fascinating season of television. It's one of our favourite seasons of television. It's amazing.
Thanks.
So many great things in there. So broadly, is that one of your favourite creative experiences, that 22 episodes of TV?
I'll be very frank.
Oh, well, that's appropriate. Like, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, I'll be candid. I am very, there's stuff in there that when I go back and look at it, I'm like, who did that?
Yeah.
That it is. I'm really proud. And actually none more so than Doomsday Defense or Somehow Satan Got Behind Me. I mean, to work with Bill Macy was a hero. My favorite year, you know, Darren and Jim and I. Even like I looked at Owls and Roosters and I'm like, wow. And to work with Tom is always a pleasure. You know, for whatever reason, and I don't, it's, you know, Lance didn't like us and it was tough. I think that, you know, the network had said, we don't want, it's Serial Killer of the Week. We're going to get rid of it. It's Serial Killer of the Week and it's humorless and we got to change. And so with Chris's blessing, we're like, well, you know, the millennium is coming. And we had read a lot about in religion, you know, revelations and there's all kinds of stuff about the end of the world. And like, maybe it's that. And Chris says, yeah, okay. And everybody was on board with it. And I don't know if Lance was ever, although we talked to him about it and said, this is what we're going to do. Like we did with David and Jillian. We always said, this is what we're going to do. And he's just never, I don't know. You'd have to ask him. He just did not trust us. So the making of that series, and plus, I don't know if, you know, Chip, really good friend, Ken Horton is a really good buddy. And he was like instrumental in helping the X-Files and we're all friends. There's no animosity, but in changing from what the first year was to the second year we came, there was, it wasn't appreciated. And I think that you can see in the third year is trying to go back to what the first year was while still holding on to some cool things they liked from year two. So that's what I'm being honest about. It was tough for Jim and I, but I'm proud of the work. And that, you know, I'm not just saying that because we're here to this.
Yeah, it's great. You should be. It's wonderful.
Thanks.
Yes. So yeah, so talking about The Curse of Frank Black itself then.
Wait, did I just ruin the mood here?
No.
Okay. No, it's fine. You're right.
You did an episode of Space Above and Beyond, which was Who Mentions the Birds? Yeah, Monitors the Birds mentioned. Uh-huh. Who Monitors the Birds? And has a very similar stylistic approach with that. Going into The Curse of Frank Black, was that on your mind to do something similar to Who Monitors the Birds? And how did the kind of... the birth of this episode come about? Was it a case of you were going to do a Halloween episode, or was it a factor that you wanted to do it rather than it was coming up? How did that all come about?
Thanks. I think that Who Monitors the Birds is one of the things I'm most proud of anything I've ever done. I don't, you know, it's just, I grew up, I liked, there was a TV series like MASH and they would do a black and white episode. They did one episode where Hawkeye Pierce had a concussion and he couldn't go to sleep. And so it was a complete monologue that Alan Alda gave so he wouldn't go to sleep. One episode had a clock in the corner that showed real time for when a wounded soldier was off the helicopter into the operating room. You know, Steve Cannell on Rockford Files, they did episodes which David Chase, who from The Sopranos is a part of, would tell a story backwards, kind of like Memento or something. And those are the things when I was a kid, I loved shows that had something different, because most of them were, you know, they catch the bad guy in 50 minutes and watch a commercial. So a silent episode, which is just what cinema is, you know, it's like tell a story through pictures. And we wanted to do that. And Rodney Rowland, who the episode is going to be about, just had a great face and a great presence. And it turned out to be like the executives are going, what are you going to do? I'm going to go get this episode. It's not going to have much dialogue. What do you mean? Well, we just tricked our way into it. It became a very expensive episode. And then they said, don't ever do that again. And I'm like, I'm sorry, because it was over budget. So when it came time to do Curse of Frank Black, it was Ken Horton, who is now on that show, had been the executive who told me never do that again. I'm like, hey, Ken, you know, when you told me never to do it again, I want to do it again. Because you had an actor, you know, you had an actor that's great visually. You know, it's like Lance Hendricks. If you're a writer out there, know who you're writing for. Lance Hendricks and Dave Duchovny are completely different actors. You could give David Duchovny 2 pages of scientific mumbo jumbo as to why the aliens are coming. Lance is going to never do that. And so an episode where he could, you know, just emote or show what that character is, because that's what that character was. And so that's where that came from.
I appreciate, thinking of Space Book and Beyond, I appreciate the winks to some of your other work in that episode. So the Chig.
Oh, yeah, I know. I don't know whatever happened to that costume. I wanted it. But no, you know, I'll say, too, like I get bummed out because a lot of people say they, you know, some websites and stuff will talk about. We did it again. You know, Kristen did it on X-Files in year 11. You know, the computers, the followers. Just a thing that I like. And then some people, you know, Joss Whedon said, I saw space and that influenced me to do Hush. And I always appreciated that he said that, but then everybody else says, oh, they're doing that. I'm like, oh, you know, so that's a bummer, but.
You got the Notorious does that make sense? There as well. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
You got that on the TV.
Love the Notorious Seven. And again, for all you people coming up with a show, you know, they come to you and they go, we want something from you guys that's not on television. They go, okay, here's this thing. And it was serialized and this and blah, blah, blah. And they go, great. And they make it. And then when it's all done, they go, what are we going to do with this? It's not like anything on television. And it's just, so that was our way of getting it on the air.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Well, we've said that the Krill cell scenes with young Frank, it's just a masterclass in showing, not telling. Mm. How do you put that kind of thing together? So you've got all of, you know, the photographs of the soldiers and the war. You've got the Goering newspaper clip. Mm. And it's just the way that it's actually told on screen. So you don't need that vocalization of it. And how is that all put together? Because it's wonderful few minutes and the conversation with young Frank and Grossel.
Well, thanks. You know, that was, we had not worked with Ralph Hemeker before. Didn't really know him. And I said, hey, I want to do this thing, like this Japanese horror movie, Quodane. And so he watched that and understood that rhythm and flow, the way that movie goes. And, you know, and then you just start working with people. That actor, Dean Winters, I had seen on a show called Oz. He was on HBO and I just thought he was great. And it was like kind of written for him, you know, and I still haven't met him. And he just came in and did exactly what you had in mind. Meanwhile, production designer on that show is Mark Freeborn, who's still like a brother to me. He still did all the more recent X-Files and all that stuff. And, but he just knows. And so they make photoshops of Dean with his buddies in the war, and just like, this is what it looks like. Mark Freeborn is a production designer who, by the way, did Breaking Bad. I think he built a super lab and all that stuff. And I would call him up and go, how much did you dress that bar? He's like, totally. because it just should look like you walked off the street, you know? And that was always the thing, like, who is this character? And so when you explain to Mark Freeborn who Dean's character was, he takes care of, there's a lot of stuff that you're watching the dailies and you go, oh, that's great. The jacket, you know, the books or something like that. Otherwise it's scripted in there. And yeah, it's just a lot of, you know, when you have a lot of people communicating at the same level, you know, you could do an episode like that. And if everybody's somewhere else, it's going to be horrible.
I said earlier, I really think that scene should be taught to students of how to show visually and in terms of script, show how, what a character, to build a character in one scene. I think it's amazing. I've never seen anything like it before.
Thanks. You're right. I really think that it's like, you know, recently, when I watched The Irishman, the Scorsese movie, that didn't get a lot of love because it wasn't Goodfellas. But there's a scene where De Niro, who we come to know now as an actor who's always in power, and Harvey Keitel's going, why did you plan to blow up this place, the dry cleaner? And Joe Pesci, who we know, Joe Pesci is like, am I a clown? Blah, blah. And it was just like, looks, that nobody moves, nobody stands up. De Niro is nervous. Pesci just looks to De Niro and just his eyes move. And there's just so much being communicated. And I think we get into this thing nowadays where everything's loud and music and blah, 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 and you lost some of that. You didn't know this was going to be all around cinema. Lecture, huh?
Yeah. We had an idea. We had an idea.
Okay.
I was just curious, Glenn, both with The Curse of Frank Black and also with Home, I think both of those episodes are often regarded by fans of The X-Files and Millennium as some of the very best the series has to offer. How do you feel about them now? You said you haven't seen The Curse of Frank Black for many years. Would you put it up there as one of the favorite things you've ever done?
You know, I'm pretty proud of it. I mean, it's all kind of personal. You know, I don't watch, the only thing I watch repeatedly is Jose Chung's From Outer Space, Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, anything my brother wrote, and really underrated The Lost Art of Forehead Sweat.
Yeah.
And we talked earlier about reading Charlie Chaplin's autobiography and somehow turning it to the kid under the bed. That's what that episode's about, what our memories can do to us, how they get rewritten. So those are the things that I really, for me, everybody laughs at me because I can't remember the Field Where I Died is close because it's, you know, thing between Kristen and I, and Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man. You know, I like that.
Kristen is so good in The Field Where I Died. It's an amazing performance.
Thanks.
She gives, I think. Yeah.
Thanks.
Really great.
I'll pass that along. I think she's outside trying to think of some chores for me to do. But I always liked her as Laura Means too. I think did a great job on that. You know, I know we're talking about Curse of Frank Black, but that's a thing. I wish I had a little more time. But when she goes crazy to Patti Smith,
yeah.
That's something that I read. Tom Wright did that too. That's something I'm really proud of. And then that's another case with the editor, George Potter. Had been, you know, network, got to close up, got to two shot. And here was George on the brink of retirement where we're going, do this music video to Patti Smith, who I knew George Potter had never heard in his life. And then just to be inundated for a week to have that song playing on, we'd have to go to the Fox Library. We need some horses doing this. And then they'd pull it out for us. I'm proud of that segment.
It's amazing. Yeah, and Field Where I Died is your favorite episode, Kurt, isn't it?
It's one of my favorite episodes. Yeah, absolutely love that episode.
But yeah, the time is now, and the end of that is incredible. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, let's turn it over to our audience then.
Yeah, the end of time is now.
Yeah, time is near.
Fox had I don't want to Fox had the Super Bowl, and we felt that, like, give us 30 seconds commercial.
Yeah.
And they didn't. And so my brother and I were a championship game or something. Darren and I were driving back from a football game in San Diego, really angry that Fox had not properly promoted Millennium. And so he said, for every second we should have had a promo, we're going to put dead air. And that's why that, you know.
Brilliant. Yeah. Fair play. Okay. Over to our audience then.
Hi, Glenn. Adam. Just to repeat for what some of the other folks have said, I would certainly hold up Millennium Season 2 as my favourite season of Millennium, so thank you for that.
Thanks.
If I can be so bold as to speak on his behalf as well, I do know firsthand from Lance that since this show ended and he went back and looked at some of this stuff, he actually is very proud of some of the work that was done on Season 2 as well. So I think he did reflect back on it and appreciate it.
I don't, you know, things that I'm fans of, if I watch commentaries, I want it honest. I hate when marketing guys get in there and make everything, oh, it was a wonderful experience and blah, blah, blah. Here's the, all of us, no matter what we do, go through ups and downs with our coworkers and it gets done. And unfortunately, sometimes it doesn't. So I don't have any animosity towards Lance. I'm just being honest. At the time, he was just not into us. And, you know, Jim and I had a thing one time, we're flying somewhere and we're in a first class, lounge, airline lounge, studio paid for it. Not like Jim Wong and I have the money to be flying first class. And we're in this lounge sitting there and I look at Jim and there's one other person sitting on the chair and it's Lance. And Jim and I look at each other like, oh boy. Uh-oh. And then he had no idea who we were. He didn't dismiss us. You know, that was cool. You know what I mean? So I don't want, having said that, to say I have some kind of grudge against Lance. I don't. Jim or anybody. So.
Yeah. But vice versa as well. And I think I just wouldn't want you to go with that impression as well.
I know. Sorry. He talks to Tom Wright. Tom Wright and I still hang out. And so we've conveyed that. So
you've perhaps preemptively answered my question already, actually. But for me, some of the material that you gave Lance in season two, and I think of The Curse of Frank Black, I think of an episode like Monster as well. For me, you've drawn some of his career best performances. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. You said about knowing your actor, whether did that creative tension even help in terms of some of the performances you got out of him?
You know, it'd be interesting to sit together with Lance and ask, but you just like look at him and it's just not Millennium. I looked at all kinds of stuff. It's weird. Lance is in like my favorite movies and I had no idea. Like he says, you know, I was in Close Encounters. I'm like, no, you weren't. He goes, yeah, I'm in Close Encounters. I'm like, what'd you play? He's like, I'm Truffaut's handler. I'm like, you're on crack. I've seen that movie 50 times. And then I watch it and he's in every scene. I'm like, when did he show up? You know, he's in Dog Day Afternoon. You know, he shoots John Cazale in Dog Day Afternoon. I'm like, what the hell? I'm so in Aliens, of course. And so it's just like looking at him and going, this is what he does best. You know, I hope I'm not speaking out of school, but, and I have great respect for this, you know, Lance is, you know, tougher life. I think he learned to read near 30 or something. And so when Jim and I are dropping some of this one time, he didn't know it was from Vancouver. It was like the beginning, the very beginning. There's the comet. And he's talking about the beginning or the end. I don't remember what the lines are, but it was like reflective and thoughtful. He doesn't figure out that we're listening to the outtakes. And so he's reading it going, when it now is the winter of our discontent. Oh, fucking writers. So I got it.
Fantastic. Well, it worked anyway. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody good to else? See you, Adam. Don't be afraid to come into the light there.
Can be Millennium or X-Files, obviously.
Hello.
Hello.
My name's Ellie, and I have a question around the X-Files. Interested to know, did you know when you were writing Home and the themes of motherhood and so on, that you wanted Scully to end up where she is in Never Again? And also, if I can sneak a second question in, which is how do you approach characters for something like season 11 when there's been such a gap in their lives, and how do you make them true still?
The mother thing we talked about, you know, I think that, I hope I don't get in trouble. I have most of my friends are women. And I find that a lot of them just really start to think about motherhood at a certain age, even those that when they were younger, it's like career, I'm doing this. They start to think of motherhood. And so it was just sort of exploring that. In terms of that now, and because all of us have conflicts, Jillian was like, where's my sex scene?
Fair point.
Yeah, and she's right. You know, I thought that was kind of, I don't know, man, sexist that Mulder was like, and that she didn't have that. Now, you know, he should speak for himself, but I don't think Chris liked, she called up and said, where's my sex scene? You know, I was watching Larry Sanders and she calls, interrupts me. She's like, let's talk about sex scene. I'm like, can I talk to you tomorrow? And so that's what that was. And so, and doing Never Again, I just wrote a whole thing and told Bowman, make sure the door closes because Jim and I were going to be gone. And if it becomes a fight, you can close the door and not see what goes on in there. But to answer your question, that was Jillian going, I want this. It's Scully's thinking about a mother, but she's also thinking about a lot of other things were going on in her, if I recall. And Mulder was away and all that. So did she not, was that the one where she didn't have an office?
Yeah. Okay. And they have that awkward moment at the end.
Right. And she still doesn't. I mean, she's still in Vancouver. Like, what do you think? Yeah. So I don't, did I answer all? I know you had one question you snuck in.
About how do you return to the characters for something like
that? You know, there's a lot went on. We weren't there. Darren wasn't there. And there's some stuff that Chris just kind of didn't want to deal with. And that just becomes actors. Where are you? Where do you want to be? Where are you going? Where possibilities of, does the show go on? Does the show, if the show ends, you know, we've taught, every one of us had a different take. I always thought Mulder should go to outer space. like Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters. He should go. Everybody had a different idea. And you're like, well, are we going to get to do this another year? Then your choices are a certain way. But, you know, talk to the actors and just say, where are you?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think we've got time for maybe one more.
Hello.
Hi.
My name's Matt. You've spoken quite a bit about your influences and series in the past. I'm quite intrigued on what you're into at the moment. So are there any modern series that you're watching or into or possibly influencing you in the future at all?
Did I watch or did I write?
Oh, sorry. What you're watching. So like as a viewer rather than a writer.
I don't want to talk about what I write, but.
Good question.
Man, I've joked, but I love Peaky Blinders. I liked Babylon Berlin. I like Ted Lasso.
Yeah, we're talking about that. Yeah, just there.
Yeah, it was weird. I'll be honest. It's like the first season two, the first few episodes, I was like, what the hell is happening? And then really turn around.
Yeah.
I love that show. But that's, I watch a lot of documentaries and everything. I know they're older, but I've really just great admiration for The Wire and The Sopranos and Breaking Bad and Better Call Sal. Kristen loved White Lotus. I'm not sure how I felt about it. Like, that's not a critical. I just like, you know, that I have a, I don't know if you guys have a Criterion channel which shows like cinema.
We sadly don't have that in the UK, unfortunately.
You don't?
No, we wish we did, but we
don't. Yeah, because they like last month they had 8 Universal Horror, Bride of Frankenstein, Invisible Man, or then they'll bundle a bunch of films, Home Invasion, you know, movies from the 1930 up to today with the theme of home invasion. And so, you know, like how they say you stop listening to new music at 30. And so I have teens and I'm like, well, what are you listening to? And then I get in the car, I go, oh, you should listen to this new thing. And then I go right to the Ramones, you know? And I try the same thing on Netflix. I'm like, well, I should look at this. Oh, I love Squid Game. I should look at this. And then I go to Criterion Channel and watch Invisible Man for the 35th time.
There's nothing wrong with sticking with what you love. Absolutely. Which is what we do. That's what we do. Talking about the X-Files and Millennium and these kind of things all the time. So, yeah.
Well, it's nice to see those old things. And then when you do watch new stuff, for example, Squid Game, or, you know, I'm not, there's another Korean series. It was an apartment building and there were monsters in it. It was just great. Those, the Korean cinema for us, it's like, what's this? What? Oh, I think like watching Parasite, you go, oh, it's a comedy. Yeah. Oh, no, it's not. Oh, is it this? Is it that? And that's what I love. I mean, our in America, even HBO or Netflix, you get these notes like, what is it? What is this logic and stuff like that? So I really love watching the shows that are not, don't adhere to those rules.
Mm. Yeah, do new things. Like the things you've written that we've talked about today, I think they broke the rules in many ways, and they did things that are built to last, you know, 25 years nearly since these episodes came out. We'd love them today. So thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you guys. And again, I really want to emphasize that that's just like Jim Wong, Chris Carter, Darren, Vince, Frank Spotnitz, all, you know, Mark Freeborn, Rob McLaughlin. It's just, you know, an enormous, Mark Snow, just an enormous team effort week after week. And, you know, 30 years ago by, I was like watching some of that stuff, Mark Snow's score. And that's what I popped out most in Curse of Frank Black watching it the other night. Mm-hmm. This like really macabre little march to it, you know, just so it's just a lot of people. I think a lot of times, you know, and I don't know why. And people want it to be in one on tour. And I just think that's nonsense. You know, it's just so many people. Okay. Now it's time for the pub.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's that one story he was going
to
do.
I have to wait 6 hours. Story. Yeah, that was about Linda Shimizuno.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Glenn. It has been a real pleasure to speak to you. Thank you for giving your time up. And
thanks for having me. I just, you know, I wish that I could be there in person. I love your country. Kristen's sister lives there. Kristen was just there.
Thank you.
Pre-COVID, I guess, and just, you know, I look forward to going back.
Thank you. Can we give Glenn a round of applause for his time? Thank you.
No stuff.
We'll see you another time, I hope.
All right, great. Thanks. All Thanks, right. everybody.
Take care, Glenn. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Yeah, I hope you enjoyed that, guys. We had a great time talking to him there. So thanks for chipping into that. And I suppose, yeah, we better wrap it up, guys, now.
Well, when Glenn Morgan tells you to go to the pub.
I think
you've got to go to the pub.
I think we'll take his advice, definitely. So, thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Do check out the podcast if you haven't already. The podcast. Thanks to Carl and Kurt for
thank you, Tony. Yep.
And we'll hopefully see you again. But until then,
trust no one.
And set you up.
And one job.
Let's try again. So until next time,
trust no one.
And
this is who we are.
Good night, everyone.
That wasn't in the script.
Elsewhere, and we made this. Academy Watch.
I saw West Side Story actually the other day, and I didn't really connect with it. So, you know, some I like and some I won't, but generally I like the idea of a musical. Disney films, the animated Disney films. Tend to enjoy them.
Of course. Are you a La La Land person? Because I was definitely a La La pet.
I hate La La Land. I just could not stand
it. Wow. Wow. We can't be friends anymore. I'm just going to hang on. How do I turn this thing off?
Yeah. I've lost a lot of friends over this opinion, but I hate it.
Garfield is the best Spider-Man and La La Land is shit. Like, what?
I just like to be controversial.
We dig music.
But yeah, just missed out on my list this year. There was the Garbage record was great, so I got head off that.
Yeah, I was surprised that didn't end up on the main.
It was close.
I was surprised to not see it.
Wet Leg, who have released two songs so far. There's another one apparently coming out
terrible
later
band
this week.
Name.
Yeah, I can't get behind it. That's what our old history teacher was called, Mr. Wet Leg. It's actually Westlake, but like, apparently he pissed himself once.
Amazing. Yeah, it's a f***ing terrible band name, but they're great.
It's like if Wet Leg toured with pissed jeans. Can you imagine?
Right in the childhood.
When I was younger, Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man looked way older than I was a kid.
He looks older than you do now.
Way older than I am. Yeah, and that was a constant thing in the cartoons as well. Like in the cartoons, like the 90s one, he looked older. Mm. And that was the cartoon I watched when I was younger, was the 90s one. And we would have done that for the show. But as soon as Disney Plus came out, I binge watched it all. And then I encouraged you to watch it.
Yeah, and I've watched it as well.
And then we started the podcast.
And we were like, oh shit, we should have saved it.
That should have been it. And then there was another one with Neil Patrick Harris in, which I probably did.
What, as in Doogie Howser MD?
Yeah, and, you know.
Ooh, I'm going to put that on my list.
A Doogie Howser.
Doogie Howser MD.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X underscore cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.